Welcome to The Leader's Edge, where we celebrate leadership and shine a light on a visionary leader shaping our future. Hi, I'm H.R. Huntsman, founder of Leader's Edge, creator of the Leader's Edge Performance Engine and Leader's Edge University. I'm thrilled to bring you stories from leaders who are making a difference around the world. In each episode, we champion the innovative strategies, courageous decisions, and inspiring journeys of those who lead with purpose and passion. So whether you're looking to refine your leadership skills or you simply want to be inspired, my friend, you are in the right place because my guest today is Ken Rusk. Ken is a best-selling author, entrepreneur, leadership speaker, began his career digging ditches at age 15 and went on to build a nine-figure business with 225 employees across three locations. He's also the author of Blue Collar Cash and the forthcoming Rockstars and Rainmakers. His work focuses on restoring dignity to skilled trades, building strong workplace cultures, and helping people create lives defined by comfort, peace, and freedom. We talk about his evolution from entrepreneur to a leader of intrapreneurs, why sharing opportunity and revenue can unlock our team's potential, and how leaders can connect personal dreams with company goals. Ken also shares his passion for restoring dignity to blue-collar work, the lessons behind blue-collar cash, what inspired his new book, Rockstars and Rainmakers. We explore his philosophy of comfort, peace, and freedom, the leadership mistakes that shaped him, and why he now measures success through meaningful memories and service to others. It's a conversation about work, culture, freedom, and building something that matters. Please enjoy my conversation with Ken Rusk. Ken, you began by digging ditches at 15, and you always call yourself a ditch digger, and you eventually built a large figure, nine-figure group of companies. I'm curious, which transformation within you mattered the most along the way?
Which transformation? First off, thanks for having me. I really appreciate being on the show. I think the very first transformation happened when I was 15. And that was right before I joined the ditch digging firm. I was my own landscaper. And I just couldn't believe that you could hire two guys, you know, pay them $3 an hour, and then charge the homeowner $5 an hour for each guy, and they would go work, and then you could go work making $5 an hour somewhere else, and you had this like group of people creating revenue, even though you weren't literally on every shovel yourself.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And so I'll never forget the power of that, and I thought, man, if I had 100 people like this, this would be really cool.
Right.
So it kind of started then, and I always knew I wanted to be in my own company, but I thought it might be cool to kind of work for one and see how these things work when it comes to scaling.
Sure.
And I know that sounds like I knew an awful lot when I was 15, but it just made mathematical sense to me. So
okay.
There it was.
Now, you've obviously, your first book, Blue Collar Cash, you promote the trades a lot, and you've built your life outside of the traditional college path. How do we restore dignity to that work without turning the conversation into a bash on higher education?
Well, it's real simple. I think I've been on 340 some podcasts. And
wow.
And it's my message to say is this. So I believe that, you know, there's 176 some odd million people working in the United States today, okay?
Yeah.
And when you look at the stats from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you will find that 50% of them, 40 to 50% of them, do something with the blue-collar trades, okay, to this very day. In fact, when you get out of bed in the morning, put your feet on the ground, and by the time you get to your work or your office, your school, whatever, you've walked or driven across 10,000 blue-collar jobs that still exist today.
Wow.
If you really think about, you know, getting deep, like not just the dump truck, but who made the dump truck, and then who made the tires for the dump truck, who made the rubber for the tires for the dump truck. So, I mean, you can see how this goes. And I've always believed that pendulum needs to be very, very balanced. And what happened was, they started taking shop class out of high school, right? Mistake number one. because that's where millions of people accidentally learned how cool it was to be a, in a trade, right? Where you were maybe turning a table on a lathe, a table leg on a lathe, or you were wiring an outlet or fixing an old Mustang in high school. So you had that problem first. They replaced those rooms with computers, and I thought, well, I mean, computers are good, but why couldn't we have had both? Why did one have to supplant the other, right?
Right, right.
Because people thought, well, manufacturing and all that stuff's going to go away. No, we made it go away, right? So then you have these schools that are very, very good at selling themselves. I mean, colleges are very good at selling themselves. They're very good at shaming parents into saying, hey, this is the only way to go. And I'm a firm believer in college. If you're going to grab a knife and come at me and cut open my shoulder and fix my shoulder so I can get back on the golf course, I want you to know everything there is to know about anesthesia and knives and before you do that. But if you're just going to study, you know, Eastern European furniture design, there may not be a job for you waiting for that at the end of that 4-year period of time. So I think there just needed to be a big balance. And that's when we get out of balance is when we have problems. And that's why you're seeing this resurgence now.
Yeah, you sure are. I was just doing some research before you came on, and it looks like the next 10 years, they're projecting about a 9% increase across the trades in the next 10 years. Like AI, college, I mean, we're still going to need all those jobs. They're very, not just we need them, they're, in my opinion, they're like the backbone of our entire country, is like you said, you just drive across them every day. Let's talk, you mentioned scaling earlier, Ken. I want to talk to you about that in your book, Blue Collar Cash, your first book. You talk a lot about hard work and the value and honor and hard work. I grew my first company to be quite large as well. And you and I both know that hard work enough is not enough to scale a company. So as you grew, I'd like you to help other entrepreneurs think about this. As you grew from, let's say, I think you started with 3 or 6 or something, 10 is a different leadership mindset than certainly a solopreneur. 25 is another level of employees. 50 is another level, maybe 100. Like you, I grew mine to 200. That's a whole different level of leadership mindset and skill set. What I'm curious about is which level required the biggest leadership or mindset shift in you and why?
God, that I got to tell you, that might be one of the best questions I've ever been asked out of all those podcasts. That's a really great question.
I've thought a lot about this in my own career. Like every level required different things from me. And I had to grow and evolve, and the old HR could not live at the next level. So, I mean, I'm curious to hear from you about that.
So when you're teaching somebody a skill and you have the teacher and the student on the job site, that's a pretty efficient thing. Here's a shovel. This is how you hold it. This is where you step on it. This is how it goes in the ground. That's how a hole is dug. When you get to the point where you're so big that you have to teach the teachers to teach, that's where it gets really challenging, because you're trying to put all of your heart and soul and feelings and your ownership for this company into someone that then needs to transfer that to somebody yet again, and maybe even yet again. So for me, I knew for a fact that I had better go from being an entrepreneur surrounded by the students to being an entrepreneur surrounded by intrapreneurs.
Yeah.
So I very quickly had to pivot to, okay, I want to treat these people as if they're owners of the company, have them be autonomous in their departments. And also the most important thing is reward them for that autonomy from efficiency and from results and in revenue and profitability and all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So when I'll never forget one day I was sitting in my office and I was wanting to take this company to the next level, one of the levels you just described. And I grabbed the 9 or 10 people that I had real entrepreneurial, intrapreneurial relationships with, and I had them come in the conference room, and I gave them all a small piece of paper and a pencil, and I said, I want you to write down how far this company can go in revenue this next year. And before you do that, I just want you to know that I'm going to share some of that revenue with you if you do it. And they all got this funny look on their face, and they wrote these numbers down. And wouldn't you know it, I collected all the numbers. Wouldn't you know it, the lowest one was $2 million higher than my own number.
Interesting.
So I didn't even write one down. I had one in my head, and I sure as hell was not going to write it down after I got all these numbers. So I literally said to him, I said, okay, well, here's the thing. This is revenue that the company doesn't have now. It's newfound revenue that you're going to go create. And when you do, I'm going to share some of that with you. So you're really making your own increase or raise or paycheck or bonus or whatever you want to call it. And at the end of this year, we're going to go somewhere really nice. And we've been doing that quite a bit. Most years we go somewhere. And I'm going to hand you these checks at this resort island somewhere. And they pretty much in sync said, hey, Ken, cool. Thanks for the opportunity. Now get the hell out of our way and let us go to work.
That's amazing.
And they launched it. And we have really never looked back. I mean, it's been a great experience. And there's a lot of things that tie into that, like personal timed pathways and syncing with company goals and, you know, synergy and momentum. And we can talk a lot about that because that's important as well. But just the start of it was not recognizing that you might be your own self-limiter. So be careful.
That's an amazing concept. Now, if I can just dig into the logistics, was it actual profit sharing? Was it bonuses? Like, just logistically, what did that look like for you?
Well, it was revenue. And so I tied a profit to a revenue, and then I had a big pot of money, and we just divvied it up according to what level they were at and how much they produced or whatever.
It was pretty
mathematically simple. And that's how I wanted it to be, because I didn't want them to think that there was any judgment on like any judgment from me, like, well, I think I'm going to give him this much and her that much. No, it was simple math, a formula that they could calculate, you know, real time.
Yeah.
And the pot grew and they knew what their piece of it was. So how much of it did you want and how big did you want the pot to grow was the only question.
I had two really difficult levels. The first one was when we got large enough where my own staff had to schedule meetings with me. You couldn't just pop in anymore. And the second one was when I didn't know everybody on staff. Because I'm a super relational guy, high relational. That felt really odd to me, like almost a success guilt as well. Did you go through any of that?
Well, I found a way to get around that, and that was through these personal timed pathways. So I wanted to make sure that everybody in this company was chasing something for themselves.
Yeah.
And this is where I write in the book, it's okay to be selfish as long as it's not at the detriment of others. So your goal should be to find as many selfish people as you can find. And I know that sounds crazy, but
no,
it's true.
I get it.
So what happens is you build a mechanism by which they can post these goals on. We have a huge public black glass board in our office. It's right behind that door. And people will walk up with these neon markers and they'll write their particular pathway. Like, I want a new F-150. I'm going to save $75 a week for 6 months for a down payment. It's January 1st, 2026. I'm going to have this truck. I'm going to order it in September of 2026, and I'm going to pick it up in December 2026, and then they sign the bottom. And before that goal becomes live, they have to go to the payroll clerk, and they have to literally say, take $75 out of my account, put it somewhere I can't touch it. And so it's an actual live thing. It's something you can follow. And so the way I got around maybe not knowing everybody was, you know, thank you for being here. I'm glad you're part of our company. Tell me, what are you chasing?
Yeah.
And as soon as they started explaining what they were after, it kind of like broke all that ice. And I didn't know everybody's name. I mean, it's 225 people in three locations, so it's not easy.
It's not easy for sure.
But if you have that, what you call through line, okay, that motivational through line where everyone is on that pathway to getting something for themselves, automatically, if they're all chasing something, your goals are going to be almost synergistic with their personal time pathways, and then momentum happens and get out of the way. So
I teach this philosophy and concept everywhere I go. I believe in it myself, and that is connecting a person's dreams to the goals of the company. And the great leaders know how to mesh those two things together. By you achieving these KPIs, I'm going to help you get that F-150.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that. I teach that everywhere I go. Let's talk about comfort, peace, and freedom. This is your philosophy from Blue Collar Cash. I was curious, as I'm reading the book, in your opinion, which of those is most hardest to achieve? And what do people, when they pursue it, actually moves them farther from it?
Well, the more you force spontaneity, the farther away you get from it, right?
Yeah, right.
So So in my mind, the comfort was the easy one, because what you're saying is, if I can draw my life the way I see it, okay, what kind of car do I want? What kind of house do I want? What kind of vacations do I want to take? What kind of dog do I want, a dog or a cat? What color? What would I name it? What about my spirituality? What about my health? What about my hobbies or sports? You can draw all those things out and say, man, if I could live like that, that would be very cool. That'd be very comfortable for me. I would love that. And the beautiful part about that is everyone that draws it draws a different picture. No one draws the same thing, which is so cool.
Sure.
So once you have that comfort, there's a peace that comes along with the fact that you know that if I'm on these individual time pathways, I have my life designed for me, so I don't have to fear or stress or, you know, be like frustrated. There's a peace that comes along with clarity, okay? I think freedom is the hardest one, though, because people just won't let go. Like they have the pathways drawn out. They're peaceful in the fact that they're chasing them, but they won't just let go and say, wow, I'm just going to take my dog for a walk in the park and maybe breathe some good air, or maybe meet another dog, or maybe talk to a random person, or I'm just going to ask my mom if she wants to go to lunch on Tuesday. I mean, the spontaneous part, the freedom part, is the most challenging. And I think when you try to force that, you get away from it a little bit.
That's the hardest one for me. I just sat on the porch last night for a couple hours with my wife, and it's hard not to think about work and what we're doing in 2027. Yeah. And it sounds wonderful, but there's a part, I think Jim Collin called it productive paranoia. There's always a part of me that's going, do you honestly struggle with that? Or are you really able to just truly disconnect?
I'm always thinking about opportunities. I think I'd be lying if I said, and you would be too, if you said, you know, you're always thinking about opportunities. Yeah. But I do have the ability to get on the first tee in my golf course and think nothing about work. Okay. I mean, not a single thing. I do have the ability to play with my grandson and my granddaughter and not think a thing about work. But if I'm, you know, just at home, you know, watching a little bit of TV or something, you know, my mind is always going, hey, what about that? Like,
for sure.
I have a group of people called the Fantastic Four. They're like the top four people in our company, the vice presidents. And they're like, the guy texts me at 9:30 at night and says, what do you think about this? and they love it because they're in too. I mean, they're in.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's not a bad thing.
I have to admit, when I first read Comfort, Peace, and Freedom, I immediately pushed back. I thought, I can't believe this guy is saying one of the things that you should shoot for is comfort. But your definition was very different than what I first thought. I was like, I don't want to be comfortable. Like, I'm 61. I'm still striving. I still love work. I love work. I love, like, explain the difference of what a person might read that and say, comfortable, really?
Yeah, well, when you think about the way you want to live, okay, again, if you're drawing this out, and I encourage people to do that. I actually have boards you can get that are pre-done. They're almost like paint by numbers. But I encourage people to draw this out, because once you have that, there is a feeling of comfort that comes over you where you say, okay, because I have clarity now, I can breathe a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay? Because, you know, I would say this. Unbridled energy that's not aimed at anything is like, that's the paranoia part. That's the part that makes people feel uneasy. But if you have unbridled energy that's aimed at something, there's a calmness that comes over you because you know you're going to get there. I mean, it's just the law of manifestation. I mean, the more you see something, the more it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So once you know that, there is a little bit of comfort that comes along with it. It's not about being lazy. It's about being chill and the fact that you know where you're going. Good. And that brings a comfortable feeling to you.
I see your next book coming out over your shoulder. There are Rockstars and Rainmakers. I heard you in Boston a few weeks ago talking about one of my favorite topics, and that's culture. The tagline is build it and they will come. I love that. Tell us more about that book, what drove it, and the connection between Blue Collar Cash and Rockstars and Rainmakers.
So I had a lot of great feedback from Blue Collar Cash because it dealt with anybody from 17 years of age to 50, okay? You can always figure out what you want the rest of your life to look like because today is the first day of the rest of your life, so let's go. And it was aimed a little bit more at the individual. Like, how do I draw this life for myself? How do I set myself up? And, you know, I always say that sometimes it doesn't necessarily matter what you do for a living as much as it does what you do with what you do for a living. So aiming your finances and aiming your effort towards the ultimate you is an awesome thing to be able to do. And that's where the comfort, peace, and freedom comes from. I had a bunch of people say to me, well, let me ask you this. If I want to create a culture that would attract that guy or attract that gal, how would I do it? Because I don't even realize that my culture just sucks. I mean, I don't even realize that when people walk in the front door, they see all the reasons why they don't want to work here.
Yeah.
You know, they walk in your foyer and they see that you have furniture from the 60s. You have Popular Mechanics magazine that are all covered in dust from 1971.
Yeah.
And the receptionist looks like she wants to die. And, you know, there's no music. It smells. It's just, you know, it's terrible. So there is a whole lot beyond the obvious, you know, sight, sound, smell, taste, color, you know, hearing, whatever. There's a lot that goes into the mindset of creating an awesome culture and to create a culture that is, you know, one that supports the individual in winning for him or herself. But that I was asked to write it because we want to know how you would create now, because you've got all these ditch diggers that are knee deep in slop every day. And I say that lovingly because I am one. How do you keep that rolling? I mean, yeah. How do you keep those people going?
It's hard.
And it's just about creating a great culture. And they're like, well, we want to hear more about that side of it. So that's where it came from.
I love it. This is one of the things I'm most passionate about. I'm also coming out with a book next year. It's called Destination Workplaces. It's the exact same idea.
Nice.
Creating places where people want to go to work. I talk about attracting and keeping top talent. Same exact idea. In fact, when you're talking about your book on stage, I'm like, wait, that's my book. Same exact idea. I love it so much. So I'm very much with you on this. I want to ask this, though. How much responsibility is on the employee to create their own good life, and how much belongs to us to create the conditions that makes that possible?
Well, I think first off, you know, we have a statement around here, if you're not chasing something, you can't work here. So let's just call that what it is.
Love okay? it. Okay.
We have that right there. The other side of it is, I think entrepreneurs get caught up in their own egos sometimes, where they are so, you know, they go home on Friday and they beat their chest and they say to their wife or their husband, man, I fixed this and I changed that and I yelled at this guy and I, you know, motivated this person and I came up with this new idea. You know, I worked 80 hours. I forgot my son's birthday and I can't remember my daughter's name, but that's okay. I now have high blood pressure and diabetes, but I made a few bucks, so that's good. That's absolutely wrong. I think as entrepreneurs, you truly need to create an environment where you're not working in your business, you're working on it, right?
Yeah, sure.
And I really believe that you need to create a place where you can have balance in your own life first. I mean, first and foremost. I mean, we all have 6 or 7 buckets we need to be filling equally all the time. And as long as everyone has that same philosophy, whether it's the employee, the employer, the chief cool officer, or the chief culture officer, which we talk about in the book. Those are all things that I think everyone needs to own, okay? We all have this life we're going through. Let's all fill our buckets equally, all right? And have a balanced life that way.
I love it. I love how you started that out. If you're not chasing something, you can't work here. I mean, it's hiring the right people that fit your culture. One thing I love about you and the book is you didn't make hard work easy. You made difficult work meaningful. And I always talk about creating places of meaning and purpose. What would you say to other business owners about creating a workplace of meaning and purpose?
Well, there's lots of ways to create culture. One of them is through giving back. And so we just talked right before we got on. I have a guy that runs my Fort Wayne office who is literally helping build a school in Zimbabwe. And, you know, we talked about, we're going to give $2,500 to every quarter of this year for him to go out. And $2,500 over there is a lot of money to help build stuff.
For sure.
And he literally broke down in tears because he was like, I can't believe I work for a company that would do this for somebody so far away. You know, and because, you know, you got to be careful. He's been there. He's actually hammered nails in this school. So it's not like it's one of those things where you never know where the money goes, right? So I think there's a lot. You know, we involve people in building peanut butter and jelly sandwiches around here as fast as they can to help the homeless. We do a lot with we build dinners at Ronald McDonald's House for people that never even met us and never will meet us.
Love it.
So it's you know, it's the charity that you never get credit for, which is fine. It's awesome. We do a lot with Make-A-Wish, where we help young families, you know, help their children get through what their challenges are. And so I think when you have a company that believes a lot in that, you know, people are afraid to give of themselves their time, their talent, their treasure on an individual basis because they just don't know how to do it and right. They don't feel comfortable.
Right.
But you walk into a Ronald McDonald's House with, you know, $82 in groceries, and seven of you create in their kitchen a beautiful lasagna dinner with meatballs and salad and garlic bread, and you wrap it all up, put it in foil, stick it in the fridge, and you go away. It's an amazing thing. And so that's all part, I think, of the responsibility of an entrepreneur, is to create not only a place where you can win personally, but you also can share of your time, talent, and treasure, which you don't do it for this reason, but it tends to pay you back.
It does.
You know?
Yeah.
So it just seems to work out that way.
I love it. We have the Huntsman Hope Foundation, my own foundation. We're working in Kenya and some of the poorest villages in the world to bring water and food and education.
That's fantastic.
I completely get it. No, absolutely right. We talked a lot about your successes. I have to ask this question. What have your greatest leadership failures taught you that successes never could?
Well, I think it was when I tried to do it all. I think that would have been, and I'm glad I learned that really early, okay? Because I was always a really healthy person, and I tried to make that way. But when I tried to do, you know, the owner thing, okay? Right now, if you put me in a parking lot with all 225 people shoulder to shoulder, and you asked a group of 10 people who's the owner, I would hope to God that they didn't pick me. Okay, just by looking. I would want to be that guy that just is part of the campus style of management of let's make this whole thing work as a team and have fun. And it's not altruistic, it's true. It's not one of those things where you're like, oh yeah, you should say that. No, it really is, because it's there's just too much work involved in trying to be that superhero all the time.
Yeah.
And you don't get to live you make all this money, but you don't get to live this life the way you want to. So I think that's part of the challenge.
I burned myself to the ground when I was in my 40s because I didn't understand that. No one taught me about leadership. I just thought you're supposed to be the guy that did all the things and had all the answers. And I didn't learn till in my later 40s, 50s, and that it's okay to say, I don't know. It's okay to say, what's your idea? It's okay to say, that's smarter than me. Like, I didn't know that. And so I thought I had to have all the answers, and it cost me a lot.
Well, I can tell you that whenever you run a company and you face the typical issues with a large group of people, you run into illnesses and you run into, you know, labor and you run into wage and hour challenges and you run into all these different things that just come at you at business. No matter how good you are, you get mosquitoed by a lot of these different weird things.
Yeah.
And you've been through that.
For sure.
And then one day you're sitting there behind your desk and the governor comes on TV and says, all businesses are to be shuttered because we have a pandemic going on. And you look and your staff walks in and they go, Ken, what do we do? And you sit there and, you know, act like, imagine I'm in my chair right now, right? I look behind me and there's nobody.
No one's coming to save you, bro.
No one's coming to save you, brother. So I literally said, well, I know that there are such a thing called essential businesses. They're not just going to, you know, let the streetlights stop. So and the sewers back up. So let's figure this out. So literally we changed not what we do, but how we presented to the world what we do.
Very good.
And we became an interior health company rather than a basement repair company, where we cleaned air and we, you know, worked on sewers and we had been doing that stuff anyway, but it was just the way we presented ourselves. So we shifted gears, and one day later, we never skipped a beat and we kept going. And I have friends who own restaurants, and they had to lay off 400 people in like 3 hours. And then they had to turn into like drive through, like a steakhouse is now a drive through steakhouse. So it was really a bizarre time, but there are, you know, when just when you think you've seen it all, right? Something like that happens, and you're like, well, hell, what do I do now?
Never seen that. In fact, I was kind of putting two and two together. Blue Collar Cash came out right before that. I was wondering, does that feel like perfect timing? It seemed like that was, I mean, you could never have predicted that, but I'm looking at the date of the book and I'm thinking about COVID and like, what great timing to be talking about the trades, right?
You know, the interesting thing was because the stores were all not so open, they actually re-released my book and it became a bestseller a year after the COVID started. So once they got a handle on COVID and like they could manage it, they relaunched the book and that's when it became a bestseller. So yeah, it's
Perfect.
pretty wild scenario.
Perfect. All right. At this stage in your life, you've built companies and wealth and people and leaders. What are you building now that can't be measured in revenue or company size or book sales or public recognition? Like, what are you working on now that's really meaningful to you, Ken?
So, another really great question. Thank you for that. So, I have a first floor pub in my house, and don't draw any conclusions from that. It's just a very nice place to have a drink. But I also have a protein shake stand in there, and I go there every morning at 7:30, and I make my protein shake, and it's got like 15 different ingredients, and so I'm in there for a bit. I have a rotating frame that sits right next to that stand, and it literally has everything I've ever done on it, all the golf courses I've seen, all the places I've been on my boat, all the things I've done with my cars, with my family, vacations I've taken, places I've been, accomplishments that I've made. And I stare at that thing while I'm making my protein shake, and all I do is I give myself 20 minutes every morning to practice being really, really grateful. And so if you ask me what I'm working on now, I think I heard this once, and I don't remember where I heard it. I won't take credit for it, but I think it was, "He who dies with the best memories wins." And so now it's all about awesome. I mean, it's been that way for a long time, but it's about looking back on all the awesome memories and my grandkids and my daughter and her husband and, you know, living that kind of life.
I've taught my kids that I say this, we're huntsmen, we're story collectors.
There you go.
We
I love it.
collect stories.
I love that.
Now you put, I'm a veteran. You put a lot of work into supporting vets and first responders. You have your bourbon project. Talk to us a little bit about that.
So my neighbor is a bourbon, I don't know if you want to call him a sommelier or a connoisseur or whatever. He has got one of the most extensive bourbon collections in the United States in his basement. He built this probably 1,500, 2,000 square foot speakeasy in his basement, and it's just lined the walls with every collector bottle and every set and everything you can imagine. And we were sitting in there. He has four easy chairs and a table in the middle. And it's one of those places where you can sit down and 4 hours just disappears or like nothing, you know? So we were in there one day, and you know, I was made honorary commander of the 180th Fighter Wing Group out here in Toledo. And I was able to get on an F-16 ride with these guys. And they're such heroes. They're such amazing human beings. And they drive these flying gas tanks at, you know, 800 miles an hour from here to Iraq and back. And it's just amazing what they do. So I said, you know, we help them out a lot with like TVs and AV equipment and building a patio for them or whatever, you know. Why don't we really try to scale this thing up? So I said, well, let's build a bourbon. And we'll give all the money to first responders, Sons and Daughters of the Fallen, Gold Star families. We'll do that. And I said, all right, rock and roll, let's go.
Love it.
So we literally just started sketching out ideas for labels, and then we got the bottle together, we got a box and the bag, and I can't announce it yet, but we have a very popular country singer now who's going to be one of our spokespeople.
Nice.
And it just has taken on a life of its own. And it's funny because, you know, when you're in business, you have to sell things. Something has to get sold. And that can be difficult sometimes. In my entire career, I've never had something sell so easy as this particular thing.
That's amazing.
And It's just, it's so cool because so many people are like, wait a minute, I can have a sip of bourbon and help a vet? Yeah, I'm in. Let me add it. So it's been pretty wild. We're just getting started. We're filling our first couple thousand bottles next week. Wow. And we have a good portion of them spoken for already. So it's pretty exciting.
As a vet, thank you very much for supporting all my brothers and sisters. And it means a lot. It means a lot that people like you do so much for that community.
Well, you know, there's a big difference, and this is where I love all the things that they do. They build houses for them. They build hotels for them. They convert old hotels into veterans' homes. You can give somebody a prosthetic leg, or you can give them a wheelchair, or you can do whatever you want to do, but who's working on their head? Like, who's working on that space that drives them every day or doesn't? And this suicide rate is... it's out of control. It's way too bad. I have vets working for me here, and they all have buddies that came back, but then took themselves out.
Right.
And we got to stop that, man. I mean, there's, you know, I just don't, I love everything about our government when it works. And yeah, we can kick ass and take names when necessary. But I've got people here who had to dig their own grave every night and lay in it so the bullets would whiz over top of their head, or in case the shrapnel blew up next to them, it wouldn't harm them. And they would wake up with, you know, 6-inch diameter camel spiders crawling on their chest, right? One guy lived that way for 6 weeks when his supply line got cut off and all he had was Gatorade to survive on.
Goodness.
And they all have friends that took themselves out. And I say to myself, if you dodged a bullet even once, you deserve everything you need to live a good life. I mean, you deserve it, whatever it takes. And so if I can work on somebody's mental state, and I'm gonna go for that.
Thank you, my friend. I have one final question, but I want to talk about your book. How can we get a hold of Rock Stars and Rainmakers? When is it coming out?
It's already on Amazon. So you can look there, and it's already on where the normal book channels are sold. You can pre-order it now.
Good.
And really, really excited about it. So yeah, can't wait.
I've pre-ordered my copy. I appreciate that. Final question I ask every guest. Imagine a young person is just coming out of trade school, or they're just beginning an apprenticeship, or they went the college route. What one piece of life or career advice would you give him or her?
I would say replicate yourself as quickly as you can, as high quality as you can, and just recognize that everyone has their own reason for working, their own reason for creating success for themselves. Expose that, talk about it, and then get out of their way, because your company's going to grow quick.
Love it. I'd love to have you back on after the book comes out. Thank you so
Absolutely.
Much for spending time with me, sharing your wisdom and insight, and we'll stay in touch for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
You bet, brother. That's it for today's show. Thank you for joining us on The Leader's Edge. I hope today's conversation inspired you to lead with even greater purpose and impact. My big three takeaways from my conversation with Ken are these. The first one, I love his quote, "If you're not chasing something, you can't work here." That's what he tells people who come to work for him. Hire people who are hungry and they want something bigger. Those kind of people are easy to point in a powerful direction. Number two is the power of autonomy. Ken reminded me that when you give high performers ownership of their working environment, they can create something pretty freaking powerful. You just got to get out of their way. And the third one is give back. The giver's gain principle is something powerful in Ken. And I love the work he is doing with our veterans and first responders. It reminds me of this thing that I say all the time. Don't just make an income, make an impact. All right. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us. I'd love a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us reach more leaders just like you. And that's the point. Stay connected with us on social media for behind the scenes content, leadership insights, and updates on future episodes. Don't forget to check us out at yourleadersedge.com and follow us at Leaders Edge Podcast on all major platforms. So until next time, keep pushing boundaries, keep leading at the edge. I'm HR Huntsman. I'll see you soon.